Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Thursday, January 8th, welcome, friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Always exciting when we have a public figure on the show for the first time, and today we have such a show. Nelson Perez is the Archbishop of Philadelphia. He assumed that role about 6 years ago. More recently, the Archdiocese of Philadelphia has launched an initiative trying to bring people back into church. Most people in this region, the vast majority of people in this region who identify as Catholic, do not attend Mass regularly. And the church is pretty clear-eyed about that from the statements that they've made. And they're trying to make some efforts through social media, through advertising, through different types of initiatives, missionary hubs around the region to bring people back to church. So we'll ask the Archbishop about those efforts. And we would love to hear from you this hour. First of all, any general questions for the Archbishop, you can send those in, studio2@whyy.org. You can call 888-477-9499. Same information for this question. What do you think the church needs to do to get people back in the pews? 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook. You know what to do. Drop a comment in the chat.
Yeah, I'd love to get people's thoughts. Full disclosure, I'm one of those lapsed Catholics.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, raised Catholic, all the sacraments and everything, but sort of, you know, stopped going to Mass on a regular basis. Started going back a little bit, but I'd love to hear what people think. Whether you're Catholic or not, what do you think churches should do to get people to come on back? 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. And it's also DJ of the day because it is Thursday.
Yes, indeed. So you could pick a song about
church.
Church.
Some prayer.
Prayer. Connection to Catholicism, I suppose.
Come on back.
Maybe returning, I suppose.
Yeah.
Welcome back, Cotter type of thing. I don't know. Studio2@whyy.org. Studio2@whyy.org. Get those song suggestions in by 12:30. We will end the show as we do every Thursday with a song picked by one of you. What was your parish, by the way?
My parish was Saint Margaret's.
Saint Margaret's,
yeah,
cool.
In Sea Pleasant, Maryland.
Was she a good saint? Saint Margaret. What, I know nothing about her.
Was a good saint. And by the way, I went to Catholic school there till eighth grade.
Yeah,
yeah. So yeah.
Catholic school grad.
Had the skirt and everything.
Yeah, doing good things in the world. You were an advertisement for Catholic school.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, let's get into our local roundup before we get to our big conversation today. Cherry, you're going to start us off.
Yes, Avelo Airlines, a company that runs flights out of the Wilmington Airport, has decided to end ICE deportation flights by the end of this month. The announcement comes in the aftermath of harsh criticism and protests of the airline and after Delaware lawmakers introduced legislation that would strip state incentives from companies that support mass deportation efforts by the Trump administration. Pretty interesting story by WHYY's Sarah Mueller. Organizers from the Delaware Stop Avelo Coalition, they're counting this as a win. Last May, they began pressuring the company to end its contract with the Department of Homeland Security. And I'll say the company has denied that it ever had a contract to help deport immigrants, but flight trackers show that it did in fact run deportation flights. And data from Human Rights First shows that the Trump administration ran more than 11,000 deportation flights between January and November of last year, and about 17% of those flights were serviced by Avelo.
Yeah, it's interesting to see a state using incentives not just as a carrot but as a stick, to say we gave you some incentives and now we are thinking about withdrawing those incentives in this case. And I wonder if we'll see just more of that around the country, whether it has to do with ICE or other types of cooperation with the federal government. This is the tug of war between the federal government and the states playing out right here in Delaware.
And by the way, those incentives were like tax exemptions for jet fuel and other types of exemptions that Delaware was given.
Because they've been trying to grow that airport, the Wilmington airport. It's not a major airport. There's very few sort of, public flights, commercial flights you can take out of there. And this was one of the airlines that was willing to operate out of there. And so they're both these parties are trying to grow this thing together. And obviously there's some tension.
Yeah. Yeah, and so we'll see that. By the way, I want to read a statement. The airline founder and CEO, Andrew Levy, he issued a statement. He said that we realize this is a sensitive and complicated topic, and after significant deliberations, they determined that their charter flying will have to provide them the type of stability to continue their expansion and to keep their folks employed. So there you go.
Story number two, and this is a story that broke a little after the show yesterday, mm-hmm. but is still just rattling around in our heads as folks working in the media space. The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, the newspaper of record for this state's second biggest city, mm-hmm. a community institution with roots dating back to 1786, has announced that it will close. The Post-Gazette will print its final edition on May 3rd, and then it will be no more. There's not going to be an online version, at least under the current plan. Employees received a pre-recorded Zoom message announcing the news yesterday from Block Communications, which owns the paper. The Block family has been involved with the paper since the 1920s. Wow. They claimed in their statement yesterday they've lost over $300 million over the past 20 years operating the Post-Gazette. There's also been intense labor strife at the Post-Gazette, including a strike that started in 2022. This closure announcement followed a court decision that would have required the Block family to honor a prior labor agreement that it had improperly violated. But here's the big picture. Pittsburgh could soon become the biggest city in America without a daily newspaper.
Yeah, this is really, really sad, especially for folks like us when we hear this and we work in news, but it's also a sign of the times. I mean, this year, Atlanta became the largest metropolitan city without a daily printed paper.
Yes.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution ended its paper edition at the end of last year. They're now digital only. And I remember back in 2012 when the Times-Picayune down in New Orleans sort of went to just 3 days a week.
Yeah.
And that was like the start of a tied where these big
yes.
cities were losing their daily newspaper. And so, you know, I'm really hoping that, you know, maybe someone, an entity will step up and step in and save this paper for such an important city in our Commonwealth.
I think someone might step in here. Mm-hmm. I actually do believe that. I don't know if it will be to save the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette or to start something new. But it's worth noting that Pittsburgh, compared to other cities of its size, has a huge philanthropic community. A lot
yeah.
of this dates back
yeah.
to the Gilded Ages, you know, the Carnegies, mm-hmm. people like that. And so I think there's a lot of money there, and I would imagine there's a lot of will. If I would encourage folks to read a piece by Joshua Benton in Neiman Lab describing mm-hmm. the extremely messy dynamics within the Block family.
Yeah.
So you said it's a sign of the times, and it is, but it's also, I think, a sign of a very tumultuous specific situation with mm-hmm. the ownership of this specific paper. And what he speculates in the piece is that the philanthropic community in Pittsburgh did not want to keep the Post-Gazette alive because they didn't want to go into business with the Block family.
And get them out of the way,
start something fresh. I mm-hmm. think if you have hope here, it's for something like that. And mm-hmm. maybe it will be someone saves the Post-Gazette as well. We don't really know.
You just want them to have a daily paper.
I think there's a possibility
yeah.
there, especially with the size of the philanthropic community in mm-hmm. Pittsburgh. I think there's the possibility for a solution. Doesn't mean it's an inevitability, but I think there's a possibility. And I would keep hope alive for that.
Yeah, let's keep hope alive because daily news, it goes into a whole bunch of other questions, like what it means if you don't have a daily paper when you're a city of that size.
Yep.
So put a pen in that one. Third story today, late night talk show host and comedian Jon Stewart will be in Philadelphia this spring, but the political commentator won't be behind the mic commentating. Oh, no. Instead, he'll be behind a drum set.
Ba-doom-tsh.
I know. That's right. Stewart will be the drummer for this year's Sing Us Home Festival, which will feature founders Dave and Tim House, Scranton pop punk band, the Menzingers, indie rockers, the Mountain Goats, and punk veteran Ted Leo, among a number of others. Apparently, Jon Stewart is a part of a band. It's called After the Cut. He actually told his audience a few weeks ago that at 62, he's not even the oldest member of his band. They have a guy named Big Jim Bova, who's like in his 70s.
All right, Big Jim.
And Big Jim's son, Andy, actually taught John how to play. So
I didn't know he was a drummer.
Yeah, I didn't know he was a drummer either. But he says he loves it because it's a mind quieting experience. So folks can go see there if he's yeah. a political commentator, late night show host that you love. You can see him at the Sing Us Home Festival, May 1st through 3rd on Venice Island in Manayunk.
I have to say, I'm going to utter the whitest sentence ever uttered, so just be aware of that. I saw a Daily Show alum, Ed Helms, mm-hmm. at a folk festival performing as part of his bluegrass trio that he got together at Oberlin College. And so I have some experience like seeing people out of their element.
That's
like celebrities.
Cool.
It's a little disquieting and mm-hmm. it's just like it's hard to get into the music because you're just so thinking about that person and you're like gauging their skills. Like, are they really good at this? And
I think you're behind the drums.
Yeah, exactly. Nice. And Ed Helms was good, by the way, at playing his instrument, but it was hard to get into the music.
Yeah.
But it was an interesting experience.
So, John Stewart is a drummer. There you go.
We're also interested in hearing more from the Archbishop of Philadelphia, Nelson Perez. He'll be with us on the other side of this break. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Studio 2. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Like many religions, the Catholic Church has experienced a steady decline in churchgoers over the past two decades. While in 2007, 24% of Americans identified as Catholics, today only 19% would label themselves that way.
So what happened? Some feel the church no longer meets their spiritual needs or disagree with church teachings on social issues. Others lost trust following the sexual abuse scandals.
Here in Philly and the surrounding area, around 1.5 million people identify as Catholic. Few of them regularly attend Mass. Philadelphia Archbishop Nelson Perez is working to reverse that trend. One example you may have seen on TV or the bus stop is a huge advertising campaign aimed at welcoming people back to the church. And the Archbishop joins us right here, right now in Studio 2 to talk about the direction the church is headed. Archbishop, welcome to Studio 2. We're so excited to have you here.
Thank you, Chari and Avi. It's great to be here with you.
Yeah,
we're listening to us.
We're excited to have the conversation with you and, of course, our listeners as well. What do you think the church needs to do to get people back in the pews? Or if you just have general questions for the Archbishop, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, how you doing? Drop a comment in the chat.
And Archbishop, I'm going to start with the big headlines today. I mean, people woke up this morning. Some were angry. Some were afraid and grieving after hearing about the loss of a woman in Minneapolis who was protesting ICE. And so I wonder how you sort of counsel faithful, especially when you have a flock, many of which are immigrants. How do you talk to them when they're dealing with such strife?
When I look at all that, I says, you know, we're better than that. We have to be better than that, right? And yes, the immigration issue is a complex issue. But as the church and our own Holy Father has spoken about over and over again, it's about the dignity of the human person, right? And respect for that dignity that's not given to us actually by the state, actually. Our rights don't come from the state. The state is there to protect our dignity and to protect our rights. And so we have to be sensitive to that and respectful of the dignity of human people. And God made us in his image and likeness.
Yeah.
And so we have to respect the divine that way.
Mm. Yeah. Last year, you wrote a pastoral letter mm-hmm. About this issue of immigration and the way people were feeling about ICE enforcement in the country. I want to read this excerpt. "As the son of immigrants, I have found recent events particularly heartbreaking. Today, I write to express my prayerful solidarity and that of our local church with you. You are not alone. The church is a community of faith, and the divine person of Christ, who was forced to flee his homeland as a child, holds you in his compassionate arms." Mm. I'm curious why you wrote that letter and what went into your thought process when you decided to release that letter, knowing, of course, that this is a lightning rod issue in America.
Absolutely. I'm the son of immigrants. Mm. I'm the son of refugees who fled Cuba looking for freedom and were welcomed in this country and gave my family an incredible opportunity to grow and develop. And because of that, I sit here today as the Archbishop of Philadelphia, right? Because of the generosity of this country and also the courageousness of my own parents, right? Why did they do what they do? They wanted a better life for me, for my brothers. They wanted a better life. And so that's a spirit behind that. At the end of the day, unless
you... Was it difficult for you to decide to do that, or was it? Did it feel natural to say, I'm going to say something, me, the Archbishop of Philadelphia?
No, it came from my heart. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it wasn't. No, it came from my heart. For me, this is not a political issue. Mm-hmm. It's a moral issue. Yeah. It's not a political issue for me. Yes, do we have... does the country have not only the right, but the obligation to defend its borders? Absolutely, without a doubt. But we have been a country that's been very open to the world, right? It's mm-hmm. the nature of this country. Unless you were an American Indian, a Native American Indian, you came from someplace else, mm-hmm. as I did, as my parents came here. It is a complex issue. We have a broken immigration system.
Yeah.
And the U.S. bishops have been calling for comprehensive immigration reform and fixing that system, as many others have for decades now.
Yeah,
but we haven't gotten around to it yet.
And Archbishop, I know the U.S. bishops came together just a couple months ago and had this statement that was released in November. You took part of that. Mm-hmm. It was the first time in 12 years that the all the bishops got together and felt the need to speak out. Why did you join the group, and what did it mean, do you think, for all the bishops from the U.S. to come together and make this message?
Because they are our flock. You know, when we are their shepherds, right? And so we speak with a shepherd's heart, not necessarily getting involved in the polemic of politics and all the different opinions. We speak as shepherds, and that's kind of the approach, right? Like a doctor, a medical doctor will treat a patient, regardless of where the patient is from or their views or their situation. Because they've taken an oath, a sacred oath, to preserve life. Mm.
Yeah. You mentioned your own upbringing and your family's history. And because this is your first time on our show, I would love to hear more about your upbringing, your story. So you're born in Miami. Your parents were exiles from Cuba. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, your mother was pregnant when she left Cuba.
Yes, I was. Pope Francis, actually.
Yeah.
Love Pope Francis. He asked me a couple of years ago because we spoke in Spanish.
Yeah, yeah.
So he said to me, "So you know the Spanish? You're Cuban, right?" I says, "Yes." He says, "Oh, Cuba. I was in Cuba. It's beautiful." So where in Cuba were you born?
You were
I said, "Well, Holy Father, I was made in Cuba.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
But I was
born
packaged
in Miami.
Yeah,
and he loved that.
I love it.
Yeah, I was born in Miami. Don't have really a clear memory because I was very young when I left there. My father, God rest his soul, was a banker. Mm-hmm. In Cuba, he was the youngest banking executive at the age of 25, ran 30 banks across the island.
Wow.
And left everything, left their home as you left your home today, never to go back.
I read somewhere that when your family got to Miami, and again, you're too young to remember this, but they were met by Catholic Charities very early on. And given from the get-go. And I'm just curious how that shaped, you know, your family's relationship to the church, your relationship to the church, being in a vulnerable position as a family and being received with welcoming arms by Catholic Charities.
By the church. The church received my family. They went to a refugee camp initially. And so who embraced them, aside from the country, specifically then, was the church.
Yeah.
The church became the entity, the home that wrapped their arms around them, mm-hmm. right, and welcomed them and helped them to get started in this new life. And so I've always been very grateful to that. And I see our own Catholic Charities here in Philadelphia do that for hundreds of thousands of people every day silently with a loving heart.
Yeah, I wonder, because you eventually came up in this region, New Jersey, that's where you were educated, and eventually joined the church and became ordained in the Catholic Church. What sort of drew you to service in this way and made you say, you know what, I want to dedicate my life in this way? And I think you were in your late 20s when you finally, made that decision.
Ordained, yeah. Ever since I was a little kid, and we went to church, because we went to church every Sunday.
Yeah.
Right? And ever since I was a little kid, I was drawn, mystified by everything that was happening around the altar. It was fascinating to me. And while other kids were, chasing Cheerios, I was fixated on what was happening there at the altar. I knew that something special, mystical, and powerful was happening there. Even as a kid, though, I couldn't explain what it was.
Yeah.
So it was always kind of there. But it wasn't until later in my life that then I said, this is what I want to do, because I felt called inside to do that. And then you start the journey of formation and discernment and doubting and all those human things.
Because it's a commitment. It's a serious commitment.
Yeah, yes. It's been 37 years now of commitment. Yeah. But I'll tell you a story. I went to a parish as a seminarian. We were there to ask for support for the seminary. And at that time, it was right before I was ordained, actually. And I was in, deep doubt. And I got up at the microphone and said, most people ask people like me actually what you're asking me. So why do you want to be a priest? And I could tell people before, give him 100 reasons why. That day I got up and said, I don't really know if I want to be a priest.
Ooh, yeah.
But give us your money and your prayers. But I don't know if I want to be a priest. All I know is I'm compelled to. This is in a parish that's now closed on Broad Street, St. Stephen's.
Yeah.
And at the end of that mass, I'm standing outside and, most people walking by, and this elderly woman comes up and she says, I'm going to tell you why you need to be a priest. And I said, I'm trying to figure it out. So what are you going to tell me?
Mm-hmm.
That's inside of me, right? She grabbed my hands, kissed my hands, looked at me and says, because I need you to be a priest.
Oh.
And then kissed my hands again and walked away. For me, that was an angel, because that day really was the first time that an individual representing the church said to me, I need you to be a priest.
Yeah.
And that's how I got called you.
And it's so interesting, because you're about to mark 6 years as Archbishop here in Philadelphia, in this region, for the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. And, you have had a really tough job, because when you came in, the church was really declining. People were leaving the pews. And instead of sort of managing decline, you decided to look at things from an expansive way and sort of think about how you can grow the church and bring people back. And you actually have started a campaign to actually talk to people and ask them to come back. Why did you choose that path, which is a little bit different than we've seen some other dioceses do?
So the first question at my press conference when I was announced as the Archbishop of Philadelphia was, so how does it feel to be back home? Because Philly was my home.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's not really common that a priest of a diocese becomes the bishop of the diocese, especially these bigger dioceses. The last Philadelphia priest to have become the Archbishop of Philadelphia was in 1918, over 100 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Right? So I come back and I says, it's amazing to be back home with everything that that means. The second question was, are you going to close parishes?
Yeah.
That was the second question.
Mm-hmm.
My response was, I didn't come here to close parishes. I came here to build up the church. Could that involve change? I said, it could involve change. It will involve change, as change is part of all our lives. I made a joke out of it. I said, I was 32-inch waist for an hour in my life. And change has been happening ever since. Right? Yeah, yes. But I didn't want to wake up in the morning managing decline. I want to wake up in the morning managing growth. I didn't know exactly how I was going to do that and when I was going to do that, but that's what was in my heart and mind at that moment. It continues to be to this day.
Yeah. So we asked folks, you know, what would get them back to church, mm-hmm. what they would do, and lots of folks are writing in, and there is a theme emerging among some commenters. I want to read a few of these. Cindy says the church needs to open all roles in the church hierarchy to women to win me back. Mercedes from Philadelphia says, I'm a Catholic who attends Mass regularly and supports my parish, but I often feel disenfranchised as a woman in the church. Come on, it's high time we are considered full equals. And I want to bring in a caller who I think has a similar sentiment. This is Regina from Hamilton, New Jersey. Hey, Regina, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is this. I'm a cradle Catholic, and I would not trade my Catholic education for anything. I'm a Catholic University graduate, and it's been very important to me all my life. However, the marginalization of women within the church and the fact that the church does not, in my opinion, respect half of the world's spirituality is a massive problem for me. I don't feel like the church can lead me any longer. And that's my very strong feeling. We've removed our children from the faith. However, having said that, I'm very grateful for my Catholic history.
Mm. And Emily in Westchester says, I'm curious what the Archbishop's take is on the fact that a decade of deliberations in the church recently ended with no significant new roles for women in Catholic leadership. So let's start there. Mm-hmm. The conclusion of this long searching process and this potential opening up for roles for women in the church, and some people feeling like it really just did not materialize or go anywhere they had high hopes for Pope Francis in that regard. They were not met. Curious for your take on that.
Well, with regards to ordination, the church has its teachings on that, right? Now, to say that that's the only role in the church is not the only role in the church, right? Mm-hmm. Right. The reality is, even as a priest and as a pastor, I have to say the significant leaders in my parishes in roles of leadership and influence and decision for me were actually women.
Yeah. You just told that lovely story about the woman who essentially inspired you to become a priest. And I think
saved my vocation, probably.
Yeah. And I'm curious. I think some people might view that story and say, then why can't that woman have, if not a co-equal, some sort of larger role in the official church hierarchy? What would you say in response?
Well, the church is moving in that direction. The Holy Father, both Pope Francis and now Pope Leo, have put women in positions that were originally and traditionally held by bishops and cardinals, right? The person who now runs the government of the Vatican is a sister, is a woman, right? That role doesn't require ordination. It requires passion and intelligence and commitment to the Lord and to the Holy Father.
You believe we'll see more of that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Most of my closest advisors are actually women.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that you've talked about is the decline in the number of priests that have come through. I think we've seen half the number in the past 20 years. There were like 1,200 priests in the archdiocese. At 2000, now it's in the 600s. Just sort of how is the church sort of dealing with that? Even if you got a whole big flux of parishioners coming back to the parishes, how do you even handle that number of parishioners if you don't have the staffing to be able to do that?
Well, one thing I would say is that we're really blessed in Philly right now, right? Mm-hmm. Because our seminary has the largest number of diocesan seminarians studying for the priesthood in the country.
Wow.
Right now. We have about 70-something of them, right? This year we'll
be... So reinforcements are coming, yes.
Oh, absolutely. The Lord is working. We'll be ordaining 16 priests within the next 2 years, 9 of them this coming May. So there's hope. There's signs of hope. And that's where my heart is, right? I know that there are challenges and issues and there always was, and there always will be. My heart really is on not what we can't do, but what can we do? Because hope is what fuels our passion. not focusing on the negative.
And one of the things that I did read was that some lay people were being brought in. That was a sign of hope that parishioners who may not be ordained have stepped up and filled the void.
Right. So rather than close a parish because I might not have a priest to send them at this time, that's not the only way of doing things, right? So we have three parishes right now that are run by, administratively, by parish life directors. And they're not priests. They're not priests. One's a lay guy. Not ordained at all. So there's a lot of ways, creative ways of being hopeful, right?
More folks chiming in. Sophia says, if you want people to come back to the church, you have to practice what you preach. Talk is cheap. Actions speak louder. Feed and house the homeless. Care for the sick. Be a space for all and not just some. I would mention first major document released in October by Pope Leo. Did talk about the plight of the poor quite explicitly. And some might even say in political terms, Leo blamed, quote, ideologies that defend the absolute autonomy of the marketplace and financial speculation for deepening equality in today's world. I want to get some further insight on how folks feel about the church's relation to the least among us, the poorest among us. And we have a caller, Virginia from Swarthmore, online too. Who I think is going to further this conversation. Hey, Virginia, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment for the Archbishop?
Thank you. My comment is that the Vatican holds so much wealth and that most of the money in the church goes in an upward direction. And I think that that is a big problem with the members of the church because they have such wealth. And it's really, you know, it's a trickle down process
Thank you so much, Virginia. I want to give the Archbishop a chance to respond. So we threw a lot at you there, but I'm curious for your initial thoughts as we have this conversation about the church and its relation to sort of the economic well-being of low-income people.
Well, I could speak from a lot of experience. I just finished 3 years as the chair of Catholic Relief Services that works in the poorest countries and the most vulnerable people in the world. I came back from Africa this August. Last year, Catholic Relief Services served 250 million people around the world by 9,000 wonderful CRS workers in these countries in about 140 countries, right? That's happening right now as we speak. I visited those places in Ghana, right? The love of the church and the love of people. Here in our own archdiocese, Catholic Charities has 40, 50 programs from youth to homeless to St. John's Hospice, not far from here, serves hundreds and hundreds of meals every day, right? Our nutritional development services, thousands and thousands of people are served. We served on a yearly basis 300,000-400,000 people. So the church's ministry to those who are vulnerable and poor and in need is vast. But it doesn't. One thing that I think has been a reality is that we don't really toot our horns too much about that, and maybe we should.
Yeah. But should there be some marriage of that with a more muscular criticism of the systems that might contribute to people being poor? Because I think that might be the direction that Pope Francis and Pope Leo are pushing. Do you think that's the direction they are pushing, first of all, but do you think that is the direction the church needs to push?
Well, the church needs to raise the voice for those in need and does it all the time. Yeah. Whether it's the Holy Father who does it, or whether it's the bishops of a country who does it, or whether it's a local bishop who does it, right? Yes, there is a prophetic voice that the church exercises all the time, has been doing it for 2,000 years, right? Has been doing that. But in addition to that prophetic voice, then there's the direct loving and caring of those who are poor, which without a doubt, the church in Philadelphia is the greatest force for good, you know, in our education, our Catholic Charities programs. What happens in a parish You know, I was in a parish that serves 17,000 lunches a year.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk more about that and many other issues on the other side of this break. We're talking with Archbishop of Philadelphia, Nelson Perez. Don't go anywhere. This is Studio 2. And welcome back to Studio 2 right here on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Archbishop Nelson Perez is with us this hour. He oversees 214 parishes in our region and a couple hundred schools. And we're talking with him about the direction of the Catholic Church and his efforts to re-engage Catholics amid declining attendance.
And we'd love to hear from you this hour. What questions do you have for the Archbishop? If you are a lapsed Catholic or just interested in this topic, what would get you back to Mass or to Mass for the first time? What do you think churches can do to get people back in the pews? 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org.
And so I want to play this clip because this is one of the commercials that sort of sucked me in and had me very interested about what the Catholic Church is doing right now. It's called Catholic Every Day. And you may have seen the campaign, but take a look and listen.
Being Catholic doesn't end on Sunday. It's where our mission begins.
I'm Catholic every day.
We embrace every moment to bring Jesus Christ to others. It's woven into everyday actions. It's who we are. Our faith goes beyond Sundays because we are Catholic every day.
I'm Catholic every day.
I'm Catholic every day.
I'm Catholic every day.
Take a step forward in faith at trustandhope.org.
And so, Archbishop, I wanted to ask you about this campaign, why you decided to go in this direction to try to get folks back in their parishes.
Well, we have embarked on a missionary initiative, right? Working with Catholic Leadership Institute. Dan Solucci came to me with a wonderful idea of establishing, we call them missionary hubs, to be facing out to those who don't come,
yeah.
Right? Facing outward. I have a wonderful chief strategy officer, Brian McCarthy, and he's put together an amazing team. All of that through the wonderful philanthropy of generous people who are believing in us and hopeful for what we're doing. And the hope is, yeah, to reach out to those who aren't there and tell them that we love them and that there's a place for them where we are in the church.
And my quick follow-up to you is I know 83%, according to the Archdiocese statistics, 83% of Catholics don't attend Mass every week. And sort of you've been doing these listening sessions. What are people telling you about why they are not coming and what it'll take to get them back?
There's a million reasons, right? There's a million reasons for every one of that 83%. Everybody has a reason, right? I think more globally, we live in a very secular environment right now where kind of God and the spiritual life might not be, or the church or religion in general, in the center of our daily stuff. Then there's hurt. Yes, there's hurt of the crimes of some. But I think at the end, though, I think St. Augustine, who Pope Leo quotes a lot, says that the human heart was made for God and it will be restless until it finds its rest in God. He's quoting St. Augustine, who spent 30 years running away from God. And his mother, Monica, prayed and prayed and prayed. And he came to that truth within himself. And that Christ, the church is about a person, right? And that person is actually Christ. It's his message. It's his good news. He's the one that comes to in our hearts, comes to our hearts, and helps us to find rest where we're restless.
Yeah. You mentioned the hurt, and Greg says, as a 25-year activist advocate for survivors of sexual abuse by Catholic priests mm-hmm. and vowed religious, I believe that ongoing scandal remains the elephant in the chapel. I want to bring in a caller now. This is Joe from Westchester on line two, mm-hmm. who I believe has a point to make on this issue of the sexual abuse scandals within the Catholic Church. Joe, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment was in myself, you know, being a victim and settling with the church and having the opportunity to meet with the Archbishop. He was very accommodating and a very good man. And I'm very fortunate to have been able to go through that process. So that was it.
You met with Archbishop Perez. You're talking about. You met with him and you found him to be accommodating. Yes. Can you just expand a little bit, Joe, on what you, what your conversation was with the Archbishop? So
people understand.
Folks understand.
Yeah.
It's hard to articulate other than he's very accommodating and was not rushed. Very loving and understanding. And it was important to me as a human being to be able to meet with him. So I'm grateful for that experience and that it worked out like that.
Is that the policy? Is that your policy to meet with people who've settled with the church over sexual abuse allegations?
Yeah, and Joe, thank you for your kind words
and what do you tell people? How do you address that with the people who are the victims?
Well, first I have to acknowledge the evil that was done, right? And say in the name of the church, I'm sorry. And then listen, you know, listen with an open and compassionate heart because they need to be heard.
Yeah.
They need to be heard, yeah. It's a dark moment for the church and bought us all a lot of pain. Yeah. Still does in my heart.
Because accountability, saying you're sorry is a first step to bringing true healing. I feel like the church is in this place of grappling with, as the world is, like who belongs and what spaces. There's a lot of divisiveness and othering that is happening. And so... I know one group of people that you have met with have been people within the LGBTQ community, something you've done. And we have Regina from Norristown on the line who wants to talk about this, I believe. Regina, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment for the Archbishop?
Oh, sorry about that. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I was raised Catholic. I loved my Catholic school years experience. I have a nephew who is gay, and he wonders often if there's a place for him and his husband in the church, because for so many years, people in the LGBTQ community have been made to feel like they are not welcome, that they are sinners, and they get this whole, like, love the sinner but not the sin kind of thing. So I'm just wondering what the church, or what the Archbishop's feelings is in regard to, you know, opening their arms to this specific community.
And before you answer that, Archbishop, I want to read this comment because it's on the same exact point. Mm-hmm. Caroline from Philadelphia says, I'm a 22-year-old lesbian who regularly attends Mass. I was lapsed for a long time, but I came back because I formed a personal bond with the parish priest, who is such a kind and welcoming man. I have never felt othered for my sexuality or lifestyle because the focus in my parish has always been on unity. Caroline says that needs to be the focus in more parishes. Mm-hmm. So I want you to address both. First of all, what is the policy? What do you tell your priests about welcoming people who identify as LGBTQ+? And do you think more priests need to be like the one that Caroline describes here in this comment?
I would say that definitely my experience is that there is this welcoming desire, and no one's going to be walked out of a church. Mm-hmm. And no one is being asked what they do or don't do or who they are or don't are. There is this. That's been my experience of church. And is there a place? Absolutely there's a place. Because the church...
What does that place look like?
Yeah. And is communion involved? Because I know a lot of people feel like communion, you know, the taking of the Eucharist is something that is very close to Catholics' hearts. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of used in some instances to sort of separate folks. And I just wonder your thoughts on
that. Well, communion is not just what you receive, but being in union with.
Yeah.
Right. In union with the Spirit and the teachings of Christ through the church. And so, yes, there is a place at the altar for everybody, right? And everybody is called to come to the altar and bring their ups and their downs and their struggles and what's in their heart. And that's what I would hope people would do, actually, that they would be open and feel free and hopeful to do that, to come and bring what's in their hearts. And we could talk about it and we could discussed and we could pray together about that. That's my hope, and I think that is the spirit that I find and have found in my own priesthood of 37 years, most of it here in Philadelphia, actually, really a spirit of a great desire to be compassionate and welcoming. I haven't heard anybody wanting intentionally push anybody away.
I do want to circle back to some of our commenters mm-hmm. heard your comments earlier about the place of women in the church and were not satisfied with the answer. Mm-hmm. I probably have to go to confession myself if I read the exact phrasing of what Cindy said, but Cindy felt it was a stock answer that yes, women can be sort of in an advisory role, but they can't sort of be in any official capacity. And why not? And why can't the church budge on that? And it can't be, and when I say official, can't be sort of ordained and can't go through the process of becoming a priest. I mean, do you feel like church teaching is just straight up in conflict with that possibility? Does the possibility even exist to you of women having some more formalized role in the church hierarchy?
Again, it's all a matter of words, right? If you define that role mm-hmm. narrowly by ordination, the Holy Father has already spoken on that, right? Yeah. If that's the way you define it. Mm-hmm. But that's very narrow. Right, that's a very narrow.
That's it's very almost, meaningful for some people,
right?
Though,
but the fact is that the role of women in the church is far beyond that. You know, my experience is that, and I can only speak of my experience, is that most of the people that work with me and around me, both as a parish priest and as a diocesan bishop, are actually non-ordained.
Yeah,
right. They're non-ordained, and they exercise roles of influence and decision making. Right.
And I just wonder, and this is what I'm because if the how does it work? Because I think a lot of people hear what the Holy Father is saying, what the Vatican is saying, the church doctrine. Mm-hmm. And then you're saying that may actually be different in practice. And that even though the titles, the official titles aren't there, the practice is actually different.
No, the practice is not different. No.
Is that what you're saying?
No. What I'm saying is that in reality and practicality, there is incredible roles of leadership for lay people, men and women, in the church that doesn't involve being ordained. You know, I was a pastor of a parish in the suburbs, of which there were 4,000 registered families, right? So 16,000 people, of which at the time only 3 of us were ordained. And most of the activity that happened in that parish didn't actually happen because of me. It happened because of other people. Mm-hmm. I had my role, but they also had theirs.
And you're saying in practice, many of the people who are non-ordained doing work are women.
Oh, in parishes? Yeah, without a doubt. Yeah, I would say that. Not any slight to us men, right? But the reality on the ground is I was surrounded by wonderful men, but a lot of wonderful women.
Yeah. I want to bring in Andy from Lansdale, Pennsylvania, as we get toward the end of this hour. Andy, we are short on time, but you're on Studio 2, and I think you had a pretty specific direct question for the Archbishop. Go ahead, Andy.
Sure. Thank you for taking my call. So I recently became a Catholic 8 years ago. My daughters are going through the sacraments. We love our local parish, but once a month we go to an FSSP Latin Mass, and the reverence there is unbelievable. The solemnity and the attendance, if you don't get there 10 or 15 minutes early, you're not getting a seat. So mm-hmm. I just wanted to see what the thoughts were there regarding the Latin Mass.
We have like 5 places in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia to celebrate the Latin Mass. Mm, yeah. And I've been to them myself, right? People in my mind and heart, you know, people need to be fed and need to be free to be fed where they. So I have no problem with that per se. It's not for everybody, and I respect that as well.
Can I zoom out from that to a more general mm-hmm. question as we wrap up here? I think what I detect from you, even just by coming onto this show, because I have to say some of your predecessors were not as open to this type of conversation. Mm-hmm. You are really trying to put yourself out into the world. And I know that's uncomfortable at times, but do you feel like you have to push yourself out beyond the walls of the church into sort of the lay world more to have more of these types of conversations? And do you think other archbishops and other people at your level in the church need to do the same?
I can only speak for myself. I wouldn't say that it's pushing myself because the church is in the world. It is the world.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not, I'm just going, the church is the world. You know, it's not like we're building separate and I have to push myself out. Right? I live in the same world. I'm part of that same world. Now, I'm part of that same world as a priest and as a bishop. So I wouldn't characterize it as I'm pushing myself into the world because I'm already there. Yeah. But I'm there as who I am, right? As Nelson Perez, but also as Archbishop Perez. Mm-hmm. I'm there as who I am. So I do that with great joy and great hope. And to me, actually, it energizes me.
Mm. Yeah.
It fills me with life, right? Because that's where life is.
Archbishop Nelson Perez, we appreciate you coming on Studio 2 and taking the calls from our listeners and answering so many questions. We appreciate you being
here. Thank you. It's great to be here.
And we have to reveal quickly our Studio 2 DJ of the day. Let's hit it.
There's a church in the valley by the wildwood. No love.
Oh, there she is, Dolly Parton. Performing Church in the Wildwood, a song written in 1857, recorded this version in 1999. Thank you, Carol from Palatin Village, for choosing that song and being our DJ of the day.
Yes, and our show, thanks so much to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gray.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. It's never a bad idea to go out with some Dolly. We'll talk to you next week.
That's right.
How sweet on a clear Sunday.